Curtis Lewa.
Two young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Lewa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Lewa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Lewa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Lewa, legendary New Yorker.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Lewa. What happened today, why, and what's next? Live, local, on it, 77 WABC.
Classic Led Zeppelin. Communication breakdown, and there certainly has been one that has existed between Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Bruta Cuomo, King Cuomo I, and your mayor, comrade Bill de Blasio, not mine, I didn't vote for him, for quite some time. And it's bled over into two main issues. The funding for the continued maintenance and repair of the MTA, and also for comrade Bill de Blasio, the mayor, to be able to have mayoral control of the DOE. The acronym stands for Department of Education, but I've always said the dumbest organization ever. First off, let's go, as we have often on this occasion, to Governor Andrew Evil Eyes Cuomo, who has warned all of us about what this upcoming summer is going to be like on mass transit.
It will be a summer of hell for commuters.
And in fact, if you notice, WABC is constantly promoting the commuter whiner line. You've heard excerpts from right before the newscast. You call 212-613-3878, and you describe exactly the horrors that you've personally experienced. That's 212-613-3878. And the mayor, who just 2 weeks ago had been ducking, juking, and jiving, doing the rope-a-dope, refusing to leave his air-conditioned SUV in order to take the subway and show that he's in solidarity with all the strap hangers who have been stranded out there, has finally been goaded into it. In fact, we just discussed that with the mayoral candidate yesterday on the Drive Home at 5, Sal Albanese, who is running against de Blasio in the Democratic primary and has acquired the Reform Party line, of which I'm the New York State chairman of. That's nyreformparty.com. He is our candidate. And he had a press conference in which, with his Metro card out, he goaded the mayor outside of the Y, where he goes every day to work out in Park Slope, to come on down and take the subway. And then just a few hours later, the mayor was spotted uptown on a C train. Hadn't been on a train in months and months and months, and this is what he said.
I think I have a pretty good base level understanding from the 20 years when I just took the subway. I never was much of a bus user, and I didn't have a car, so it was essential to my life.
Oh, really? Oh, really? He continues.
I would just take the subway when it was convenient, when the schedule allowed for it, etc. I'll certainly do that and do that more now as we focus on the issue.
That's de Blasio on the rebound. Suddenly he decides that on occasion he's going to be a strap hanger. On the line to discuss that is Ken Lovett, Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Daily News. Thanks for coming on board again on the Drive Home at 5, Ken.
It's good to be back.
Okay, so again, we have two issues in which neither the governor or the mayor will pick up a phone and have a normal, civilized conversation with one another. Let's first start with the MTA. The mayor has said he's not going to contribute any more to the general fund for maintenance and repair. Other candidates challenging him for the mayoralty have said, no, 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 the city should up its ante, should up its contribution. How does this, if at all, ever get resolved, Ken?
Well, during the budget, when they have to make agreements. Look, this was an issue a year or two ago when they were working on the capital plan for the MTA, and the governor pushed and successfully pushed for the city to up its ante. They didn't go as high as the governor initially wanted. And, you know, the governor right now is sitting on a possible time bomb, because while it's going to be the summer of hell for commuters, which isn't necessarily good for the mayor as he's running for re-election, he's not really facing much of a challenge that anyone could tell. And the reality is, it's the governor who runs the subway system. He tries to run away from that fact recently, but you know, the governor controls the MTA. And if this is a huge issue, and if this explodes, the governor is extremely strong in his poll numbers in New York City. And he needs that because, you know, in 2014, he lost a lot of New York State outside the city. If he gets damaged in New York City because of this, this could affect him next year when he runs for a third term.
Well, he keeps pointing to the critics of his in terms of his ability to maintain the MTA subway service performance. He keeps saying, don't worry about it. I got this conference coming up in which we're giving away million-dollar prizes for some brainiacs from Genius Solutions that it can come up with a cure. He can't really be depending on that, is he?
He says he is. He's hoping they find some way to modernize the MTA a lot more quickly than they have been. The reality is, I mean, this is not, you know, to be fair, this has not started. This didn't start under Andrew Cuomo. It really goes back. And George Pataki, the, you know, Republican governor from back in the 90s, mid-90s, he really starved the MTA of a lot of money, and that's when a lot of these problems started, and really no one has addressed it since. And now it's really coming home to roost, and it is a major problem. And this is even before we talk about what's going on with Amtrak and Penn Station. But the subways, you know, they have old cars, they have an old signal system, and really none of this work got done over the years. And the governor, meanwhile, still hasn't appointed a full-time, a permanent person to run the MTA. His MTA chairman left in January, and we still don't have a permanent appointment.
Well, Ken Lovett, on the educational front, you mentioned George Pataki when he was governor and Rudy Giuliani was mayor. Giuliani was saying, we need to blow up 110 Livingston Street. Give me control of the Board of Education. The state legislature would not do that. They eventually did it with Bloomberg. Now I see there seems to be a coalition of state Republicans in the Senate and also the governor who may stand in the way of Mayor de Blasio's ability to call the shots with the Department of Education. Where is that at?
Well, everyone says, Democrats, Republicans, that they are supporting narrow control, or the houses are. I shouldn't say everyone, but the houses are. And that they want to extend mayoral control, which expires at the end of this month. The Senate Republicans, however, in exchange for extending it, want some kind of deal on charter schools to increase the cap, allowing more charter schools in New York City, and some other concessions. The Assembly Democrats say, no, we're just going to do this as a straight extender. And the governor really came down. He floated what he said was a compromise, but really packed the Senate Republicans yesterday. To the point when I asked the Assembly Speaker, Carl Hastie, yesterday, if he's disappointed or disturbed that the governor is siding with the Senate Republicans over his fellow Democrats, he just sighed and went, same song, different day.
Okay, but you have the UFT and the Democrats in the Assembly in Albany who are totally opposed to the expansion of charter schools. They don't want to raise the cap. The Republicans in the state Senate clearly do. Cuomo does. De Blasio is beholden to the UFT because of the support they've given him. If he does not nudge on this, your professional thoughts on this, will they then snatch away his ability to run the Department of Education and go backwards when it used to be run by a coalition of appointees of the various borough presidents and the mayor?
I think right now it's a high-stake game of chicken. I think eventually it will be renewed. Whether that's before the legislature leaves and ends their legislative session on Wednesday, I don't know yet. The governor said he's pessimistic that that will happen. In 2009, this expired. Mayoral control law expired and wasn't renewed until late August, right before the school year started. So it has expired before, and they're going to have to put together the old Board of Education. And next May, if it's still not renewed, they would have to put back the community boards, the 32 community boards that were patronage mills. So I don't think anyone really wants to go back to them. I mean, some lawmakers do, but for the most part. So I think right now everyone is posturing, but it's a very strong possibility that if they don't get a deal by Wednesday, that they'll go home for a few months and then deal with it down the road.
My sense is that Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, really doesn't have many strong allies in Albany under any circumstances. Is that to his fault?
Yeah, I think, look, the Senate Republicans despise him, which is why they're giving him such a hard time on mayoral control. In 2014, after he took office, one of the first things he did was try to flip the, and he worked aggressively to do it, he tried to flip control of the Senate to the Democrats. It didn't work. He's been paying the price ever since. They've only been giving him one-year mayoral control extenders. Each year they'd extended a year. This year they're playing hardball again. The Assembly Democrats, a lot of them just, they don't like the administration. They feel that there's been little communication. They feel that they don't take their problems seriously. And frankly, they're not strong, strong supporters of mayoral control. They vote for it. They don't want to hurt the Democratic governor, but it's not their main issue. And so in this issue in particular, he doesn't have, like, people going to bat for him really strongly.
Do appreciate that. That's Ken Lovett, Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Daily News. As the communication breakdown continues between Andrew Evilize Cuomo, King Cuomo II, the son of Mario Faccia Pruta Cuomo, King Cuomo I, and Comrade Bill de Blasio, your mayor, not mine, because I didn't vote for him.
Imus in the morning.
So far, so good.
And the drive at 5.
There are so many ways to do it.
On air, online, on the app.
That's unbelievable.
77 WABC.
I-25. So President Donald Trump flew down on Air Force One to Miami today. He was welcomed by little Marco Rubio, at least that's the way he called him, what he called him during the campaign. And the U.S. Senator of Florida was all for toots in praising the president because of his rollback of the Obama-era engagement with Cuba.
A year and a half ago, a president, an American president, landed in Havana to outstretch his hand to a regime. Today, a new president lands in Miami to reach out his hand to the people of Cuba.
And then the president himself took to the microphone and said this.
Our new policy begins with strictly enforcing U.S. law. We will not lift sanctions on the Cuban regime until all political prisoners are freed. Freedoms of assembly and expression are respected. All political parties are legalized, and free and internationally supervised elections are scheduled.
On the line to discuss it, Herson Barrero. He's my TV partner once a week on Wednesday nights on New York One, where we debate the issues of the week. He's also one of the editors at the City and State publication. Herson Barrero, what's wrong with what the president just said?
Well, hell is going to freeze over if all those things that Donald Trump conned, you know, the Cubans in Little Havana this afternoon. I was watching him. I said, how can these people be so gullible? And then little Marco Rubio believing this, you know, sucking up to this guy when he knows he's lying. None of those things are doable, Curtis. Look, the reality is that you're dealing with a regime that has outlived every president since, you know, for 60 years already. Do they really need the United States? He's living in La La Land. He's going back to talk this nonsense that they talk in Little Havana. The fact is that what President Obama started was the right path. Now all of a sudden he's playing politics like if it was a campaign rally. The election is over, dude. You know what I'm saying? It was said, look, the Cuban government, look, I'm not an expert on Cuba. I was there for 5 days. You've been to Cuba. You know how strong those people are. You know how nationalistic they are. They're not going to let any president, especially the idiot that they consider that is now in the White House, to be able to dictate. It's one thing that I saw when I went for the 5 days at the end of last year. I was there for New Year's Eve. The Cuban people don't like, they don't love Raul Castro. They didn't love Fidel. But I'll be damned, at least to the people that I spoke, average people, not military people, they do not want anyone coming to dictate what they're going to do. The change is going to come within. They're an established republic, just like the United States. By the way, Curtis, when he was sounding off all these political prisoners, I thought at one point he was going to say, nada de Oscar López Rivera. I mean, come on, dude. There are political prisoners here in this country, too. Are you going to wait to liberate them? And, you know, we just had a rigged election. His words, Russians interfered in the election of the United States, and you're talking about celebrating free elections in Cuba?
Well, now, Herson, you yourself have been to Cuba recently. I was there years ago. Describe to our audience what you experienced, both in terms of what you liked and what you didn't like.
Well, it's certainly a closed society, no doubt about that. It is not heaven. It is not paradise. It isn't hell either. I saw people walking around. I got to tell you, I saw the only military people I saw were in the parade on January 2nd, celebrating Military Day over there. And for the rest of the time, I saw police officers with these pistols that were like from the 1950s here in the United States. I didn't see anybody armed. People were walking out freely. I mean, and I went to different parts of Cuba. I did not get to see all of Cuba. I wasn't there. It was only 5 days on this. And my impression is that there are a lot of needs like there are needs here. There are bad roads like we have them in New York City. You know what I'm saying? Potholes. There are people sweating like they sweat in New York City in these horrible conditions in subways, which they're paying $3 for to get a ride from to work, and they're late all the time. So what we're talking about is a society, yes, a closed society. There's no internet service. It really stinks. It sucks. And the reality is that it's not, again, it's not hell and it's not paradise. I have to go back. I have to be able to be there for a longer period of time, travel inland. I travel to some other parts of outside from Havana. But it isn't the hell that people portray. So I think that Americans, U.S. citizens should travel over there. It isn't certainly what is portrayed in Little Havana or this political rally that using taxpayer money and lying to Cubans over there like, oh, I'm going to change this and change that. It's silly. If you follow Cuban, you know, what the Cuban history has been with the United States, you can say this is laughable. It's insulting to Cubans pretending that somehow this is going to happen. By the way, that violinist that played the Star Spangled Banner was a horrible violinist. I didn't like the way he sounded.
Well, let me tell you something. Herson Barrero, you could do me a solid. I know you want to go back there. I'd be more than happy to pay for one-way tickets for you and your family to move to Cuba. You could broadcast from Radio Martí. You could write for the loan publication, the government-controlled publication there. But I have a feeling with all the love you have for Cuba in your heart, you will not leave the good old USA because you would be an absolute fool to do so.
The Drive at 5. On the air, on the app, Curtis Sliwa, live.
One more Curtis Sliwa.
Local.
There's a guy in a red hat.
On it.
Everybody listens to Curtis.
77 WABC.
Sound of the Circus. Used to be an annual event in which the trains would come into the Sunnyside Yards in Queens. And then the elephants and the other animals of the Barnum and Bailey Circus would come trekking through the Queens Midtown Tunnel, right below us, 17 floors down in Madison Square Garden, where they would perform. But they are no longer performing. They're out of business. In the meantime, the City Council of New York, the 51 Slackers and Deadbeats, are pushing forward with an effort to ban wild animals, period, from all circuses. The Health Committee voted unanimously just yesterday to approve the bill to ban performances by elephants, lions, and other exotic animals, and it'll go up for a vote by the full council next week. On the line to discuss this is Ben Johnson. In fact, he is the Universal Circus Director of Operations, which features elephants, horses, zebras, camels, and a pony in its performance that has taken place in all five boroughs. Thanks for coming on board at the Drive Home at 5, Ben.
Thank you for having me, Curtis.
Well, it's right on time because when we saw the demise of the Barnum and Bailey Circus, especially because they no longer had the elephants that so many parents brought their children to see, I knew it would have ramifications and would affect the other circuses to come to town, but you have not capitulated, right? You have not folded. You are not removing animals from your performance, are you?
No, we have not. We just performed there this year with our animals, and we look forward to returning next year.
So what do you say to those critics, particularly animal rights activists, who say that by keeping the animals that you use in your productions in captivity and transporting them around the country and requiring them to perform tricks night after night for the human's amusement, that it is inherently inhumane?
Well, I think that's where we have a big divide there. I mean, we both agree that animals should be treated humanely. You know, the circus does, so do animal rights people. But their whole argument is that just the very nature of a person or an animal performing is cruelty, and it's not. We treat our animals very well. We go through multiple inspections across the country with dozens of independent inspectors as well as veterinarians who look at these animals throughout the year in every market we go to. And so we just completely disagree with their premise. Unfortunately, they're trying to lump everybody into one category because you have one or two bad apples in the bunch, and that's not the case with us.
Now, have you ever had an opportunity to face off with your critics, the animal rights activists, when you've done your performances? I know you're regularly featured on Family Day at Roy Wilkins Park in Southeast Queens. You've been at Floyd Bennett Field, right there along Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn, on the way to the Rockaways. Have any of the folks ever been picketing outside or protesting or handing out literature that you had an opportunity to just cop a squat, sit with, and discuss your differences?
Well, we have not confronted them when they have their protest out front. You know, we believe certainly that there is a right to free speech, and we certainly believe that they have a right to protest. So we don't do that in that forum. We have had dialogue over the years between us and them in a less confrontational format. But, and again, we both agree you need to treat animals humanely. And so there's no difference there between Universal and the activists. The difference is their opinion is that performing animals are abused, and that's not the case with us.
Now, the tradition of circuses in America, every young boy always wished at some point, I want to run away and join the circus. There are obviously less and less circuses that do performances. Just give us an idea of what your yearly schedule is like, how many people you employ, and how many people you bring joy to.
Well, if you look at the New York market, the number of tickets number of people that come through our gate in the New York market ranges between 140,000 to about 170,000 per year, between the boroughs and, you know, we consider Newark as part of that market. But across the country, for example, this year, we're going to do 16 markets. We'll do about 42 weeks of this year of shows. In other years, we've done as many as 29 to 30 markets in a year. And so in one year, calendar year, we'll see about 1 million people under the big top.
And how many employees do you have, and how many animals are part of your entourage as you travel?
Well, the tour has about 125 performers. This year, we have two elephants. We have six horses in the horse act, and then we have a pony, four zebras, and four camels in the mixed animal act. So the majority of the performers are human performers. You have, about 12 to 14 acts normally per season, and of those acts, you're going to get two or three that are animal acts.
I do appreciate that. That's Ben Johnson. He's the Universal Director of Operations. I remember seeing them opposite the old Yankee Stadium, the house that Ruth built, not the house that Aroyd and Jeter built. It used to be right next door over by the Bronx Terminal Market. And I remember kids from the Bronx who, other than going to the Bronx Zoo, had only the circus, the Universal Circus, to actually experience what wild animals were like, tame, to be able to perform before their families and friends. And what a shame now that we're no longer going to see those performances down below in Madison Square Garden by any circus, or out there at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, or out at the new Nassau Coliseum, or even over at the Rock in downtown Newark. What a disgrazia. What a shanda.
Deep connections, deep understanding.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
He's a man of the people.
77 WABC.
551. You know, before you know it, it'll soon be the one-year anniversary of the killing of the jogger Karina Vetrano, right there in Spring Creek as she went out for a nightly jog from her home in the new Howard Beach section of Queens. The whole world began to watch as her father, Phil, had found her body as he was searching through the weeds out in that Spring Creek area late at night, along with the police. And then there was week after week, month after month, as the search continued for the killer. And at times, there were literally no leads whatsoever. Leads would appear, and they would suddenly vanish. And then I remember Phil Vetrano came on, the father, and he talked about familial DNA searching. I had never heard of that, although I found out from Phil that it had been used in 10 other states to try to determine DNA testing of suspects. He described it then, and it was a long uphill battle because there were many critics. There were civil libertarians and law professors in the New York Civil Liberties Union that said, oh, no, that testing would target people of color in particular as a racial bias and an ethnic bias. Well, I'm pleased to have Phil Vetrano back on the program today because by a vote of 9-2, the New York State Committee on Forensic Science passed a policy that will allow familiar DNA searching to track unknown killers and rapists. Thanks for joining us again, Phil Vetrano, here on The Drive Home at 5.
Thank you, Curtis. Always a pleasure.
Wow, you, your wife, your family, and your supporters must feel so good today that the death of your daughter, Karina Vetrano, has led to this precedent-breaking means of research that now the police and the investigators can use to track unknown killers and rapists.
That is right. Today is a good day. Today was a victory for justice and for truth and for every law-abiding citizen out there. It was a victory today. We accomplished a miracle, what we did.
Well, now, describe for our audience, as you did for me months and months ago, Phil Vetrano, what exactly is familial DNA searching? Because we're familiar with normal DNA searching. You take a swab, you put it in somebody's mouth, then you check it against records. How is it the same or how is it different?
The only way it varies from that is when there is DNA left at a crime scene and it doesn't match anybody in the database, they run another test with the same DNA and they can come up with a match, a partial match of a criminal that has been in jail, locked up, that is a relative of this unknown DNA. So basically, it's just another lead. It narrows it down to a father, a son, or a grandfather. That's all it does. But it gives the police department an invaluable tool that they didn't have before.
Now, I remember when we were talking to you right here on the Drive Home at 5 and you first mentioned it, you got a lot of blowback. There was a lot of resistance. Did you expect that?
I was told that it was impossible. I was told to forget about it because it's not going to happen. And I was told to let it go. But as you know, I did not. And between me and Karina, we got it done.
And who assisted you in the process? Because obviously there are many people before who have been on the outside looking into the legislative process. Was there any one man or one woman who sort of carried the water for you on this through the legislative process?
No, it didn't go legislation, Curtis. That's what we didn't want. We didn't want a law. We just wanted a policy, like you mentioned before, because now it's not a law. Law would have taken legislation. Law would have taken votes. I just pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, and I made them act. And they did. And the right people voted the right way.
You know, you're very wise, because if you had brought it before the 51 city council members that we have,
right,
they probably would have shot it down. And definitely the assembly up in Albany would have done so. If you can give us an update, where are you at in the criminal justice process in the prosecution of the guy named Lewis who has been held responsible for killing your daughter?
That, Curtis, I cannot elaborate on. You know, there's policies and the procedures, but I really can't say anything about that case, Curtis. Sorry.
No, I appreciate that. I will tell our audience, though, on occasion I've had the chance to visit the site, which is now a shrine to your daughter, Karina Vetrano, in Spring Creek Park. And Phil not only maintains it and not only grooms it, but you also take care of a lot of the feral cats in the area, which when people come passing by, they say, wow, look at all these cats here that are eating good food. And that's as a result of what you do right near your daughter's shrine.
Well, Curtis, you know, I don't know if you're being, but you know as well as I do, the cat houses that are there, you placed them there. They were you and the guardian angels that put them there. So I have to thank you for that, but I feed them, yes.
Yeah, no, you do an excellent job. And how is it now? Because before your daughter was murdered, I go back there, and there was a lot of activity. It's obviously been groomed and shaved down and made more usable and habitable since the death of your daughter. But do people still use it to the same degree that they used it before in Spring Creek?
I would say yes, they do.
And I can assure you that there is a one guy who's on patrol. Every time I visited with the Guardian Angels and our Animal Protection Director, Nancy Regula, You've actually texted me because you can see me from one of the cameras, or you're actually on your bicycle patrolling the area and you wave out to us.
Yes, that is what I do, Curtis. That's what I do now, yes.
All right, well, thanks. Thanks for keeping the torch and carrying the torch on behalf of your daughter, Karina Vetrano. Unfortunately, so many victims of crime. Once the headlines disappear, it's out of sight, out of mind. But Phil Vetrano, his wife, his family, his supporters, pushed for familiar DNA searching against all odds. The civil libertarian said it could never be done. And yet the will of Phil just pushed it through by a 9-2 vote today before the New York State Committee on Forensic Science. Good work, Phil.